The seniors lunch is something we have traditionally done year in and year out. It's not commanded. It's not a holy day, obviously, except it's on the Sabbath day. It is a seniors lunch to honor our older folks among us, of whom we have an increasing number. We also honor our seniors, of course, with the unleavened bread treat boxes that our younger families prepare for the days of unleavened bread. And we commonly, as you know, ask that our seniors go first in food lines and places like that, the picnic or whatever. We try to show some deference and respect for the elderly among us and send them to the front of the line. Sometimes it gets a little difficult to tell who should go to the front of the line, and sometimes the person who should go to the front of the line doesn't want to tell who should go to the front of the line. So sometimes we have to guess. Judy and I were recently in Branson for the minister's meeting up there, and I happened to be standing next to, I think, the person who was second to me in the room. I knew that I was the oldest in the room, but I think there was a person very close to my age standing next to me. And I said, go ahead and get in line. And she said, I'm not the oldest here. And I said, no, you're probably not. I'm probably older than you. I know we're very close. I never did find out how old she was. But I said, you can go ahead and go anyway, because I have other things to do. She said, I don't want to go first in line. I said, okay, I'll go first in line. So anyway, we kind of kid around about that sometimes. Not that we're worried generally about being old or people knowing our ages. I'm generally not bashful about that. I like to tell people I'm older than dirt, like Mr. Pierce, but that doesn't always get it. You know, it doesn't always work. Why do we do these things? Why do we defer to our seniors? Why do we have a seniors luncheon? Why do we do seniors treat boxes? Again, none of these things are required, but they seem like a good idea. Why is that? And when we do that, does it carry further responsibility for our seniors? Does it put them on the spot to do something in return? What are they doing? What are they supposed to be providing? What are they offering to us? You may be surprised to know, unless you already do know, that the Bible doesn't give us a great deal of very direct instruction on this matter. It gives us only what I'd call minimal instruction. But sometimes we have to take the subtle hints that the Bible gives us and tie them together a bit, or come to understand through, if you look, in many cases, it's one of those situations where you have to read the whole Bible to find out how it all fits together, to find out what God is saying to us. And interestingly, a great deal of negative emphasis is put on our fathers, as they're called, especially beginning with ancient Israel, and how they have conducted themselves and where they have failed to pass on the information that they should have passed on to their children. So sometimes God's word is not so complimentary of our fathers, grandfathers, senior citizens. On the other hand, it's clear what God intended from the beginning, which, like everything else man does, he didn't follow, he didn't accept, he didn't acknowledge, he doesn't follow through on. But there are reasons why we do what we do, and we have to take sometimes the minimal instruction and see what else we can pull out of it. Let's go back, first of all, to Leviticus chapter 19. Leviticus chapter 19. God, in the process here of talking everything about this, from the Sabbath to demon spirits, whatever, says in the middle of this context, verse 32, you shall rise before the gray-headed and honor the presence of an old man and fear your God. I am the Eternal. So God says, rise before the gray-headed. In other words, to show them respect, show them deference. To acknowledge that they're old, to acknowledge older than you are anyway, and in some cases today, gray-headed doesn't necessarily even mean old, but the point of this is the age. Rising before the gray head, showing a certain level of deference, as it goes on to say, honoring the presence. Doesn't say honor the work or, you know, honor this specific situation. It says honor the presence of the old. And so we have to, again, draw out a principle from this. That God is telling us that he wants us to be looking to previous generations. He wants us to be looking to those who have learned lessons that they've had time to learn that we haven't had time to learn. We all know the old story, and I heard it again recently, maybe here in this pulpit, of the young man who says, I was at 16, I thought my dad was the dumbest person I ever knew, and I knew far more than he did. By the time I was 25, I realized I didn't know anything, and my dad knew everything. So there is that breakover point, in a sense, when youth grows into adulthood, when all of a sudden what seemed so obvious years before is no longer so obvious. Well, I'm here to tell you, from my perspective, that process continues through life. I do not claim to be, you know, wise and expert in very many things, but at the same time, I can tell you, I feel much more knowledgeable and aware of the realities of life today than I did 10 years ago, or even 5 years ago. In other words, the aging process and the education and the experience and the synergy, if you will, of putting it all together continues through life. Now, you have to use it, you have to work with it, and we're going to go there later in the sermon, but the point is, older folks, generally speaking, have a tremendous amount of experience, and if they have used that experience properly, and if they have mixed it with God's Spirit and God's law, they are going to be, generally speaking, much more prepared to deal with issues. They're going to be wiser, they're going to be more capable of dealing with issues than they were before. Now, I want to put a caveat on that, because it's still true. You know, we ordain elders in the church who sometimes are 30 years old. I say that sort of tongue-in-cheek, because we also used to ordain elders when they were 22 years old. And yet many of them are still serving in the church today. You know, Mr. Waterhouse, who just died, had served the church for 50 years, 51 this summer, and was ordained as a young man right out of college. It does not necessarily hold true, because you hear these stories about this one or that one or the other one who flared up and blew out, or whatever term you want to use, that everybody who was ordained young did that. That is not true. There are many people who served in the ministry for 50 years having been ordained as young people. Why were they ordained as young people? Because at that time and place, they had more education and training in the Word of God than most of the church, and they had been proven by their daily responses and their daily fruits, their daily work, either in the college or some other environment, to be spiritually stable in the way they lived their lives. We didn't just ordain people just because they had a college degree. Generally speaking, we ordained people because they not only had the college training, and in most cases a degree, but they had the college training, they had the experience, they had the personal mentoring of somebody else who was walking alongside them. They had been taught a great deal, and they had been given a certain amount of confidence in the work that they were able to do. I look back at it now, I was a little older than the average person that was ordained, but I was only, hadn't yet turned 25 when I was ordained, and I went out 6 months later to pastor a church, or two churches, and I look back at that now, and I realize I had a great deal of confidence. I had a great deal of confidence that I knew the truth, that I knew how to teach the truth, that I knew how to counsel people about problems, and there were some nitty problems in those days. And sometimes we don't know ourselves, and I hadn't thought much about this until, again, up in the Branson meeting, I happened to be sitting at lunch with Mr. Sargent, who's slightly my junior, but Mr. Sargent was actually pastoring churches, having gone directly to Ambassador College out of high school. He was out and ordained and pastoring the churches in New Mexico when I was pastoring in West Texas. And so we had a couple of occasions together. And I hadn't thought anything about this, but you know me, I'm going to talk about whatever's on my brain, so here it is. Anyway, he said to me, we were talking about something, I can't even remember what it was, but I made some comment about not fully knowing or understanding how something worked. And Greg looked at me and shocked me by saying, well, I never thought of you of ever lacking confidence. And all of a sudden you have this epiphany that people look at you in a different way than you, and you look at yourself. And I said, what does that mean? He says, well, clear back when we were young in, you know, New Mexico and West Texas, you didn't seem to have any hesitation to deal with issues or, you know, solve problems or whatever. And I got to thinking about that, and I thought, well, that's true, but was that vanity? Was that just my personality? Or was it partly the confidence you have, because God says you can have it, that if you know what's in here, and I probably knew it in the academic sense better then than I know it now. I know it better now in terms of what it means and how it all fits together and where to go find it. But in those days, I could rattle off from memory all kinds of things that I can't tell you from memory today. I had no hesitation to walk into a visit and sit down and have people ask me questions and flip open my Bible and give them answers on almost any subject. I can't do that today. I have to think, where do I start? Let me think. There's a scripture somewhere that says, you know, and you kind of muddle through for a little bit before you can get started. Now, remember what the question was. Why did we ordain people at that time? How can we call somebody who's 22 an elder who might be going out to sit and visit with somebody who's 82 and has had a life full of experience? I have a little story. My younger son, Randall, who's up in the north, of course, has a black and white picture on his wall that I have had for 45 years and never posted, never did anything with. But when he saw it, he said, I want that. And it's a picture of me as a 25-year-old, probably not even that. No, I was about maybe 23. Probably a 23-year-old sitting on a porch of what I would have to call pretty much a shack somewhere either northern Louisiana or southern Arkansas, which is an area we visited a lot in those days. And I'm sitting on the porch with this ancient lady in her chair with a Bible on her lap that looks like she borrowed it from Noah just after the flood. She's sitting there with this Bible on her lap that is well used. And even now I look at that picture and I think, what did she, you know, I don't remember the visit, kind of remember the general situation, but there were a lot of those in those days. And you kind of have to wonder, what did she ask me and what did I say? I mean, in one sense, you're very thankful there were not recordings going around following you or these cameras or selfies or whatever they're taking now. You kind of are glad you don't have that information. But on the other hand, it would be intriguing to be able to ask yourself 45 years later, what did she say? And what did I say? And how would I say it today? And how would I evaluate what I said then? Thankfully, we don't really have to do that except to ask ourselves, have I learned? Have I grown? Can I continue to serve in that way and accomplish that purpose? We ordained those elders because they knew their Bibles, because they knew the truth, because they had proven by their fruits that they had a certain commitment to the truth. Now, not all of them panned out. Let's face it. Some of them, as we say, blew out. But large numbers of them continued in the ministry until old age. The question originally was, why do we honor the seniors? Why do we recognize the seniors? And if this verse right here in the Bible were the only one we had, we'd still have ample reason, wouldn't we? This is a commandment from God. Rise up before the gray hair and honor the presence of an old man and fear your God. In other words, the two are tied together. We show by honoring older folks that we do fear God, that we're not so all-important and self-focused that we can't take time to show deference to somebody older than we are. And even older folks generally feel that way. In fact, it's interesting, most of us who are older, and I can now start to count myself in that category, those of us who are older don't necessarily feel as old as we are, unless we have, you know, a limited number of aches and pains and crises of sorts, but I'm saying mentally you still think you're reasonably young. And I have often thought about deferring to somebody who's older than I am only to find out that they're 10 years younger than I am. But I think of them in the sense that I'm young, so if they're 60, they got to be older than I am. And I realize, no, I'm 13 years older than they are. You know, that's a shocking thing to your brain sometimes. We have a common basis, of course, for this that God is leaning on when he says that, Exodus chapter 20. And you surely know where I'm going here, Exodus chapter 20. Verse 12. Exodus 20, verse 12. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the eternal your God is giving you. So the commandment does not talk about the elderly per se. It talks about your father and your mother. Though again, in principle, we would understand that to also include your grandfather, your grandmother, maybe your great-grandfather and your great-grandmother, because you're honoring those who brought you into the world, as we say. You're honoring those previous generations. And if you think about it, remember it said, rise up before the gray hair and fear God. If you think about it, if you honor previous generations and you back that all the way up to creation, you're honoring God. God created us in His image. And He intended that we pass on information and knowledge and understanding from Him to the next generation right on down through history. Did that happen? Of course not. Man cut himself off from God in the garden. The tree was shut off from him. He does not have the Holy Spirit. He did not follow God's commandments and God's laws. And one of the things he quickly gave up was honoring his fathers, his grandfathers, his previous generations. Now, for some period of time in Israel, that actually occurred, and especially in the direct line of the patriarchs. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, some down farther down, even down to David, would say, the God of my fathers, or you who made promises to our fathers, or gave this land to our fathers, later generations would say. So there was a recognition of sorts that we didn't come by it by ourselves. We are inheritors, if you will, of what God gave our ancestors. That's true of us today. No matter who we are, no matter what our heritage is, what we have today is in large measure a result of what our parents and grandparents and great parents gave us, even though sometimes those parents had huge problems. Sometimes they might have even interrupted the process of blessings. I have talked to families, and it's a sad thing when somebody says, I have no connection with my family because my memory of my family is everybody was evil, basically. Everybody was against each other. Everybody was against me. I cut myself off from my family because they're not worthy to be part of. That's a sad and terrible thing, but it does happen. Again, that's not what God intended. It's not what God designed. It's what Satan the devil has done to mankind. God said, honor your father and your mother. Think about it. We talk a great deal, and maybe we don't use the terminology today like we did when I was younger. Been a lot of times that I was younger, but the fact is we used to say the generation gap, the generation gap. We talk about the generation gap. There is always a certain generation gap between parents and children. Doesn't matter what era they live in. The question is, how do they bridge that gap? I mean, if you're 20 years older or 30 years older, today people are starting families when they're 40, so they're going to be 40 years older than their kids. You think there's a gap? You think there's a gap in the culture, a gap in the education, a gap in the technology, a gap in the lifestyles they live? Fly down to Cuba and rent a car. You know, there's a gap. So the gap has to be bridged. How is the gap bridged? The gap is bridged by doing what God says and teaching the next generation. But Satan has created the generation gap by cutting parents off from their children, cutting children off from their parents, preventing that education and sharing and discussion that produces fruit. I go and see our children working with their children who are, we have two sets of younger children in the family, and they're working with them and teaching them and guiding them, and you see the fruits and you see the results and you think, what a beautiful thing that is. And we have experienced it in our own lives, so we understand how that works and we understand how it feels. But that's what God intended, that we teach one another and that we pass on the knowledge and the understanding generation to generation, and that all of that goes back to the Creator God. Chris and I had an interesting discussion before church that was very short, but it was interesting nevertheless, and talking about some of the early things that God must have given man and some of the things that God has since taught man, and how all of these things were supposed to work. Some of you were in New Braunfels. I gave the Bible study in New Braunfels about the restoration of all things that Paul talks about in the, or not Paul, but Luke in this case, talks about in the book of Acts, of the restoration of all things. And we don't know exactly what things were like in the initial creation. So when we see everything restored, we're probably going to be a bit surprised ourselves, because what we think is going to be restored to a level that we would consider the original is probably not the original at all. The original, as God created it, was probably considerably different than anything we can even imagine. Just like what he's going to produce in the world tomorrow is going to be unlike anything we can imagine, even though he gives us a general outline and some descriptions of what's going to take place. Let's go to Psalm 78, please. Psalm 78, we could just as well, in a sense, go to Deuteronomy chapter 6, but I think the point that this is made hundreds of years later in David's time says something as well. Psalm 78. Psalm 78, verse 1, give ear, O my people, to my law. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known and our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children, not only our children, you see, but their children, telling to the generation to come the praises of the Eternal and his strength and his wonderful works that he has done. For he has established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers that they should make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, the children who would be born, that they may arise and declare them to their children, that they may set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments. Now it goes on to say they'd be different from their fathers because their fathers forgot the commandments. But the point being there that he's saying here, clear up hundreds of years after Israel came out of Egypt, God gave us a law that we should pass on information to our children. Of course, we give occasional child-rearing or family sermons that include that point. But I want to make it here in the context of seniors and the elderly among us, and not only our need to defer to them and respect them, but their responsibilities as God gives it to them. Or shall I say, your responsibilities, if you happen to be among that group. God appointed a law. He established a testimony. He said, this is the way it ought to be. If that's true, don't we think it was true when he put Adam in the garden? Weren't Cain and Abel supposed to be instructed in the same way, that God is our creator and God said, do this and don't do that? Wasn't Cain supposed to know? He wasn't supposed to rise up and kill his brother? Well, of course he was. That was supposed to have been passed on by his parents from God. And we don't know that it wasn't, at least to some degree, passed on, but certainly by their example, they had already shown that obedience to God was not important to them. We have to show by the way we live that obedience to God and praising God and worshiping God is important to us if we expect our children and grandchildren to pick up that message. I would be devastated to find that my 10, 12, 13, 15-year-old grandchildren, or even 6-year-old grandchildren, do not know that I believe that our first duty and responsibility is to God, for whatever level they can phrase that. I'd be devastated to think that they didn't know that I believed and tried to obey God, because I have a responsibility to them to make that clear and to live that way and to set that example. Lost my place here. Okay, Deuteronomy 6, I'm not going to go there, but you understand that it says, teach your children when you walk by the way, when you rise up, and guide them and direct them in the way that they ought to go. Teach them about God. Now, we learn as we go, as I was saying earlier. I think I can say that I know a lot more about God and God's way today than I did when I was ordained at 24. I know it in a different way. I know it by a combination of experience. I know it by living it. I know it by seeing what other people have gone through. And I know it by continuing to learn it out of God's Word. Experience by itself is not necessarily the answer, but it certainly does help, as the Scriptures also show. While we're here, let's go to Psalm 37. This is slightly out of context, but Psalm 37 makes an interesting observation. Psalm 37, verse 25. David says, I have been young. This is Psalm 37, verse 25. I have been young and now am old. I've lived my life. I have been young, now I am old, yet I have not seen the righteous forsaken, nor his descendants begging bread. What's he saying? He's saying, I have a lifetime of experience to tell me that the righteous are going to be taken care of by God. I haven't seen the righteous forsaken, nor his descendants begging bread. That's an amazing statement, since David lived primarily in an unrighteous nation. But there were righteous people, at least in their own limited context. And David says, I haven't seen the righteous forsaken nor seen begging bread. What am I trying to say here? That this is a combination of knowing the truth and then living through the process. David is passing on a lesson that includes the knowledge of God, but also a lifetime of experience in seeing how God works, in seeing that God does take care of his own. So, let me try to color in the picture here if we're missing it. The elderly among us, if they obey God and have been obeying God, are able to make the same kind of observation. That is, they're able to say with some personal conviction and authority, I know how God works. I know how God lives. I know how God wants us to live. I know where the pitfalls are. I know where the mistakes are. We are currently writing a ministerial training lesson on the subject of pitfalls in the ministry. And I am not the primary writer on this particular lesson, but a counselor, assistant, if you will, or sort of a... I'm just a wall to have things bounced off of, I guess you could say. But, you know, I stopped, thought about it when they asked us to do this, and I thought, you know, I don't sit around and think about the pitfalls in the ministry. I'll have to think about that. I'll have to consider it from, again, a lifetime of experience in the ministry. And I'm sure I'll be able to come up with them, and I'm sure I'll be able to help the younger man who's writing it put it together. But it's not something you sit around and think about and say, oh, I got to watch that pitfall or watch that pitfall. But if you're asked, what about this? Chances are you're going to recognize it. No, you don't want to go there. Don't do that. Don't say this. Just in the past month, I have counseled two or three different ministers in my region. I wouldn't put it just like that. I wouldn't say it like that. I wouldn't make that phone call. I'd go sit down and talk face to face with this person. That kind of counsel. Those are pitfalls that if you just said to me, what are the pitfalls in ministry? I wouldn't think about, because I don't have a list of pitfalls. But I do have a list of history and experience that when somebody asks me a question about a practical application, I know what the answer is. That's the way our elderly people are. Some of them are experts in certain physical fields of endeavor. You can ask them and they can tell you. If you're one of those people that says, I can't do that, it's rocket science, you're going to go see Dr. John. Because he knows about rocket science. To him, what he wants to say is, oh, that's easy, that's rocket science. Yeah. That's rocket science. If you want to know about gardening, you may want to go talk to Mr. Scott. You know, if you want to know about something else, you're going to talk to somebody else. Physical experience, we understand, but we need to recognize that one of the reasons our seniors are supposed to be honorable is they're both knowledgeable in that physical experience and the principles of the truth, the law of God, and how it affects the way they use that experience. That's the way we are supposed to function. Yet many times, younger generation, and I'm speaking to younger for the moment, the younger generation will not be fully attuned to that. Let's go to the book of Isaiah here. Isaiah 35. I'm sorry, that's not right. Isaiah 3, 5. It's hard enough when you can't read other people's writing. You can't read your own writing. It's really bad. And this is typed. Figure that out. Isaiah 3. These, of course, are prophecies of what's going to happen in Israel then and in our future now. But notice, I want to make an oblique point here out of verse 5. The people will be oppressed, everyone by another and everyone by his neighbor. So that's obviously a terrible environment to be in. But notice, the child will be insolent toward the elder and base toward the honorable. So God is saying, children shouldn't be insolent to elders. Today, most parents, frankly, would not take the time or think it's important to teach their children not to be insolent to older people. I hope all of us would take the time to teach that. But in society, everybody's equal. You're equal with your father, your grandfather, whomever. Somebody was telling me the other day about a child who said to his dad, it's none of your business to tell me what to do. Duh. What's that about? The child will be insolent toward the elder and the base toward the honorable. That's a function of society that's going to come upon us before the abomination of desolation does. The King James, I think, says the child shall behave himself proudly against the ancient. Doesn't matter that you've got gray hair and you've lived 70 or 80 or 90 years, and I'm 7, I'll say and do what I please. I think I've mentioned this before. Our child rearing classes in the Growing Kids God's Way series, Mr. Ezzo calls it becoming wise in their own eyes when they're 3. You know, wise in your own eyes. You know the answers. You don't need anybody to tell you. All right. In Job, the book of Job, chapter 12, I want to read a few verses here from this chapter. They're a bit disconnected. And of course, we know that in the book of Job, we have different people talking to Job. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong. But God has recorded certain principles in these conversations that help us to understand certain things. Job chapter 12, verse 9. This is Job speaking now. Of course, remember, he was a prophet of God. Verse 9, who among all these, referring to the fish and the birds and everybody else, who among all these does not know that the hand of the Eternal has done this, in whose hand is the life of every living thing? That is, God has everything in his hands. As the old song said, he's got the whole world in his hands, and the breath of all mankind. I frequently find myself either thinking about it or just automatically, almost by habit, saying thank you for the breath of air that we breathe. Interesting, you know, we don't think about the breath of air that we breathe. And I don't want to get to the point where I don't think about the breath of air that we breathe when I say to God, thank you for the breath of air that we breathe. In other words, you could become such a habit that you're not even really thinking what you're saying to God. That would be a mistake. Does not the ear test words and the mouth taste its food? In other words, God created all this. God designed all of this to work a certain way. And among that is this statement in verse 12, wisdom is with aged men, and with length of days understanding. Wisdom is with aged men, and with days, or years in this case, comes understanding. Now again, on a physical level, that could be true if a person did not even know God, but studied his life and his environment and his trade or his career, he might be wise and understanding on a whole range of levels. But ultimately, as we see in verse 13, with him, that is God, our wisdom and strength, he has counsel and understanding. We'll come back to that in a moment. But notice that he does say here, the wise, or the aged men, should be wise. Wisdom is with the aged, and understanding with the time you've lived. You process things. You amalgamate things. You synergize things. you create an understanding, a fabric of reality that is closer to true reality than what the average human being lives with. Because most human beings, frankly, don't live in reality. They live in a make-believe world of one kind or another, either a very unrealistic positive world or a terribly depressing negative world. You and I are trying to live in reality, and that wisdom comes with time, and it comes, as we see in verse 13, with God's help. And we'll go there in a moment. Going on down to verse 20, he says again, in the negative side, in terms of what the penalties are going to be, he deprives the trusted ones of speech and takes away the discernment of the elders. Takes away the discernment. So there is an expected level of discernment. Please follow me here. I'm talking about the fact that God intended it to work a certain way. And he intended that older people should have a certain level of wisdom and discernment because of their experience and because of their understanding of the principles of life. The fact that they don't is a combination of a whole lot of things, including the fact that parents don't pass on information to their children. We don't bridge the generation gap. And the fact that we don't know as a world, as a country, as a city, we don't know God's way. We don't know God's truth. So you can't necessarily find that understanding and wisdom in old people. I see on the news frequently examples of both. I see interviews with older folks who learn quite a lot and who make a good deal of sense. And I see other news items about older folks who've committed the most idiotic crime or done the most horrible thing at 75 or 80 or 85 years of age. So it isn't automatic. We need to understand that. Let's go over to chapter 32, where it makes it clear that it's not automatic. Job 32. Chapter 32, a statement here, verse 9. And interestingly, he's in the same context as the spirit and man. Verse 9, great men are not always wise, nor do the aged always understand justice. So it's not automatic that somebody's older, somebody's lived a good life, somebody's experienced, by good I mean a number of years. He says great men are not always wise, nor do the aged always understand justice. It would be nice if it were true that you could go to any older person and get good, sound, wise counsel. And your chances are much better there than they are anywhere else. But you can get bad counsel from older folks as well. It just isn't automatic. Let's go to the New Testament, please, to Titus chapter 2. I don't know why I put this here, but we might find out when we read it. Now, wait a minute. I don't want to go there first. I want to go 2 Timothy 3. We'll come right back to Titus. So if you've already written it down, if you're one of those folks who writes it down, we'll come right back there. But let's go to 2 Timothy chapter 3. You know this one well in your mind. If you don't remember it, you will when you get there. 2 Timothy chapter 3. Verse 1, but know this, that in the last days perilous times will come. For men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents. There's one of the problems. Unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal. It just goes on and on. A terrible list here. This is a culture that has rejected the lessons of history. It's a culture that has rejected the lessons of the elders, the lessons of their parents and their grandparents. So they are despisers of people other than themselves. They focus their attention on themselves. Now, one of the problems in our current society is that the younger generations, maybe two of them, have not been educated to look to their elders and to history to find answers to problems, and so they seek them among their peers. Now, if I'm 13 and I have a problem and I want an answer, where should I go to get help? Well, it's painfully obvious to another 13-year-old. Go to somebody else who has a similar problem and similar experience and let them tell me how to cope with my problem. Don't go to my 28-year-old parents. Is that old enough? No. 38-year-old parents. Don't go to my 38-year-old parents and ask them, how should I cope with this? What do they know? They're 38. They're ancient. Go to my 13-year-old peer and get good counsel, because surely he or she understands. See, people turn away from the older generation, and part of that is the older generation's fault. Not just one generation, but several generations going back, because we have fallen down on the job. We have failed to pass on the truth and the kernels of truth that would help them to live effectively. And so we don't do what we're supposed to do, and therefore, over time, that chain is broken. That chain that God talked about when he said, go back and ask your fathers and ask your father's fathers. Let's go to now Titus chapter 2. I said I would go there. Titus chapter 2, because here is the antidote to that. Titus chapter 2. He's speaking here, of course, to Timothy as the pastor of the church. I'm sorry, to Titus, not to Timothy. This is Paul speaking to Titus. And he says in chapter 2, but as for you, speak the things which are proper for sound doctrine. So here's a young elder who's being taught how to pastor, that the older men be sober. So Timothy, here I go again, Titus, as a younger man, is supposed to help the older men learn how to be sober. It doesn't mean sober from booze. It means serious, serious-minded and stable. Help them to be sober. Teach them to be sober. Reverent, again, respecting God and whatever God has created. In behavior, not slanderers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things, that they admonish the young women. Oh, sorry, I jumped ahead. I'm having trouble here today. That the older men be sober, verse 2. Reverent, temperate, sound in faith. I see what happened. My eyes picked up reverent in verse 3. Reverent is in verse 2 and 3. Reverent, temperate, sound in faith, in love, in patience. Teach the men to do this. That's part of the reason we have Christian Leadership Club. We are working toward learning some of the things we might not learn in daily Sabbath services, weekly Sabbath services. Verse 3, the older women likewise. So he's saying to Titus, Titus, teach the older women this. Teach the older women that they be reverent in behavior, not slanders, etc. Verse 4, that they admonish the young women to love their husbands, to love their children, to be discreet, chaste, homemakers, good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God may not be blasphemed. So he's telling the pastor to teach the older women to teach the younger women, because those older women probably were not taught by their parents, and they don't know that they're supposed to teach the next generation. So now the church has to step in. And Titus, as the pastor, has to say to the older women in the congregation, you know, you need to be teaching the younger women these things. They should have already known that, but they don't. Certainly true today. Sometimes the church steps in and teaches things that everybody ought to know, but don't. Everybody don't, but doesn't. Everybody, that's a bad sentence because you can't make it work. Everybody is singular. So it's doesn't. We're supposed to know, but we don't. I remember back in the early days, some of you old-timers will remember, when Mr. Armstrong first held the first graduation exercise in Big Sandy in 1965. He got really frustrated because local people showed up in their work clothes and muddy boots or, you know, T-shirts, the old overall suspenders and things, to graduation. Mr. Armstrong expected it to be a nice, uplifting, positive, formal occasion like it had been in Pasadena for years. He didn't know the East Texas environment and culture, didn't know those things. Nobody had been taught. So Mr. Armstrong had to undertake over the next few months an education process of the church and the spokesman clubs and the college and so forth and Big Sandy to teach people how to live up to a higher standard in those social, cultural things. They were not necessarily spiritual, and yet they had spiritual overtones. And he had to step in, the church had to step in and start teaching them. And when I went to Spokesman Club in 1963, we were taught how to dress, we were taught how to tie a tie. Now, problem is, I've been tying it mine the same way ever since, and probably the style's changed, but they teach you how to tie a tie, to wear dark socks with your suits, to the white ones I was wearing, you know, things like that. The church had to step in and teach things because generations had not been taught in some parts of society, certainly in my part of society. Teach from generation to generation. Here he's saying, do it in the church. If it's not being done in the family, do it in the church. And so we do some of those things from time to time in various contexts in the church. This was not supposed to be a two-part sermon. I did not pay a bit of attention to when I came up here. Those of you who have to go, I'll see you later. Now, what I'll do is we'll finish this, but we'll finish it much quicker. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 3, because I want us to understand that as Christians, we have spiritual resources and spiritual tools that make it possible for us to be and do things that we otherwise could not. And mankind doesn't know what he doesn't know. We've always said, he that doesn't know what he doesn't know. Verse 18 of 1 Corinthians 3. Very long context here that I won't try to read, but Paul says here in verse 18, let no one deceive himself. If anyone among you seems to be wise in this age, let him become a fool that he may become wise. Sometimes we have to unlearn what we think we know before we can learn. And Mr. Armstrong, again, used to always say, it's harder to unlearn what you have learned than to learn something new. In some cases, people had such false concepts and ideas, especially about religion, about the Bible in their minds, that they first had to unlearn that. Some of us were blessed in not having too much of that. And so you could start sort of on a plane to learn. But it's harder to unlearn than to learn. But God says here, if you think you're wise, that's a good sign that you're probably not. So let him become a fool. That is, say, I don't know anything. He doesn't mean a fool that says there is no God. He means become foolish in the sense that he's not wise. Verse 19, for the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God. Now, this, of course, is not a blanket statement that applies to everything like maybe how you dress or you know, some of the physical things we teach each other, how you swing a baseball bat. This is talking about spiritual things. The wisdom of this world is foolishness with God, for it is written, he catches the wise in their own craftiness. And again, the Eternal knows the thoughts of the wise, that they are futile. So mankind doesn't have answers. Therefore, let no one boast in men, for all things are yours, whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas or the world or life or death or things present or things to come, all are yours. There are resources you can call upon to learn what you need to know, to be wise. Verse 23, and you are Christ's and Christ is God's. So he says, if you think you're wise and you want to be wise, well, give up your wisdom, which is worldly, spiritual, earthly wisdom, as he calls it later, and seek God's wisdom. Where do you get that? Psalm 111, I think we all know. Psalm 111, he said, all these resources are yours, and Christ is, you are Christ, and Christ is God's. It all comes down from the Father of lights who created all of these things. Psalm 111, verse 10, one of a couple of places that say this specifically, the fear of the Eternal is the beginning of wisdom. A good understanding have all those who do his commandments. His praise endures forever. See, human beings, even of 70, 80, 90 years old, can have worldly wisdom. Some people are looked at as almost inhuman in their wisdom on certain subjects. I suppose we could throw somebody like a name like Warren Buffett out, you know, the Oracle of Omaha, they call him, because Warren Buffett supposedly is able to figure out the market and always invest in the right things and make billions of dollars. And he can be physically wise, and his age has taught him a great deal. But he still doesn't know God. The fear of the eternal is the beginning of wisdom. And a real understanding, a spiritual understanding, is going to come from those who obey God. So even we, as elders in God's church, and by that I mean the elderly, not counting myself as an elder, but those of us who are elderly, those of us who went to the senior luncheon today, we have to recognize that even our wisdom does not come just from our age. That should play a part, but it comes from obeying God. It comes from the wisdom that God makes available to us through His truth and His word. So we can't be wise without God. Certainly our younger people can't be wise without God, but our younger people can be wise with God and much wiser than the elderly who don't know God. You see the point. The real wisdom comes from God. In James, we're instructed by the Apostle James in chapter 1. James chapter 1. Verse 5, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all liberally and without reproach, and it will be given to him. Now, of course, you have to ask in faith. It goes on to say, let him ask in faith with no doubting, for who doubts is like a wave of the sea driven and tossed by the wind, for let not that man suppose he will receive anything from the Lord. That's another thing we have learned, you see. Part of our wisdom is to know that we can't go to God with a wishy-washy, half-baked approach and no faith and expect God to hear our prayers. But if we go to God with the right attitude and the right frame of mind and looking for wisdom for the right reason, God's able to give it to us. We could spend an hour on this context, but I'm not going to do that. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 5. Hebrews chapter 5. This whole context, of course, for some period of time, talks about spiritual maturity. In verse 12, talking about being teachers, but needing somebody to teach us. You see, Paul is saying, you ought to be wise. You ought to be able to teach. You're old enough. You've been around long enough, in this case, perhaps even in the truth, that you ought to be able to teach, but you have some need that somebody teach you the first principles of the oracles of God. So he's making this point. In verse 14, he says, but solid food belongs to those who are of full age. This is spiritual age, spiritual maturity, spiritual accomplishment, spiritual fruits, an established record of spiritually sound living. Solid food belongs to those who are of full age. He's contrasting that with milk, which belongs to babes. And how does he describe this, those who are full age? He gives an explanation. Those who are full age, that is, those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil. That little reason of use phrase has to do with your experience. How long you've been doing it. How much you've practiced using it. How much have you applied the law of God in the answers to your life problems. By reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil. So we're still learning that. We're still processing how to use God's truth to make judgments. And sometimes those judgments are completely new to us. You know, we're contemplating retirement in a couple of years, as you know. And all of a sudden, there are a lot of new questions that we didn't have to think about before. And sometimes it's not fun to think about. You want to just put it off. If you've seen the commercial on TV where the guy's doing the fertilize all over the yard or whatever, you know what I'm talking about. You don't want to answer that question. But it's a new question. So we have to apply the same experience and judgment and principles that we use for other facts of life to say, how are we going to handle this? How are we going to do this? How are we going to make this work? Psalm 37. We've been talking somewhat about wisdom, though that is not directly the subject. It's the life experience that makes us who we are and how we relate to God and God's truth and God's power. Psalm 37. Trouble here today. Psalm 37. When we're looking for wisdom, We should look to our elders. We should look to our older folks, those who have experience, especially experience in the truth. And we should expect this, Psalm 37, verse 30. The mouth of the righteous speaks wisdom. The mouth of the righteous speaks wisdom, and his tongue talks of justice. The law of his God is in his heart. None of his steps shall slide. You see, if you want true wisdom, you go to somebody who's walking with God, somebody who's living according to God's law. Somebody who may be old, yes, may be ancient in your eyes, if you're in your teens or your 20s or whatever, somebody who's 60 or 70 or 80. I look back now and think about my younger years and even my childhood and how somebody might have seemed to be ancient when you find out they were 35. You know, they were 35, but they sure seemed old then. You wonder how long they were able to live. Psalm 90. I close with this, Chris. Psalm 90. Here's what it comes down to. You know, those of us who are older don't automatically have any wisdom. We don't automatically know the answers. But we have a life of experience that if we weave it together with God's truth and understand the law of God and how it works and the consequences of that law, then we have a certain level of wisdom. And we can continue to learn that wisdom by applying those laws to the questions we face in life. Psalm 90, verse 12. So teach us to number our days, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Teach us to number our days. Think about it. You know, the older you get, the more you number those days. You start to wonder how many of them you have left. Teach us to number our days, that we may gain a heart of wisdom, a real true relationship with God, because it is the fear of the eternal that is the beginning of wisdom.